From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Another Republican congressman who has refused to wear a mask to prevent the spread of COVID-19 has tested positive for the virus. Representative Louie Gohmert pulled out of a scheduled trip on Air Force One with the president today because of the test result, and Attorney General Bill Barr had to be tested after being exposed to Gohmert yesterday.
Meanwhile, COVID-19 has now claimed 150,000 lives in the U.S., and several states are recording their highest single death toll to date. Let's bring in Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's an emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. And Dr. Nguyen, the number of new cases is showing some signs of leveling off in some of the hard-hit places like Florida, Texas, and California, but other states are seeing an increase. It really looks like there's no longer a single epicenter of the pandemic here in the U.S. The virus is basically everywhere. How concerning is that?
It should be extremely concerning to all of us living in the U.S. and really around the world, because we know that we cannot be islands. We're in a much worse position than we were back in March, April, when we had one major epicenter of the New York area. Now we have many epicenters. And there is not much for us to celebrate right now. There are still escalating infections all around the rest of the country, including in the Midwest. And the parts that have seemed to plateau, they're plateauing at a really dangerous place that's overtaxing their healthcare system. Their ICUs are still overwhelmed. And so the plateaus that we're seeing do reflect the policy interventions put into place 2 to 3 weeks ago, and they are effective to some extent. But I think at this point, we have two options. If we stay the course and keep on putting together these piecemeal solutions, in a sense, it's whack-a-mole. We stabilize when things reach a critical breaking point, and we try to prevent that breaking point from occurring. Or we can take much more dramatic action now and actually put into place those policy interventions that will be painful in the short term. But if we have any chance of schools being open, people going back to work, then those are the sacrifices that we do have to make in the short term.
Yeah, you're saying a second lockdown. It's really one of our only options. That's what I'm hearing from you.
I mean, I think we as a country have a choice. We can decide on this path of continued high numbers of infections and preventable deaths, or we can do the hard things. And I hate saying this because nobody wants a second lockdown, and we wasted the first one. We should have done a lot more and just stayed the course the first time around. But I think if it's any lesson that we learned, it's that there are no shortcuts. We know what it takes. We've seen other countries be successful in crushing the curve. We can do it too.
We've been hearing from Dr. Anthony Fauci and others that young people now account for a significant number of the new cases that we're seeing. What does that tell you about the direction of this pandemic and possibly the language when we talk about who's most impacted by the coronavirus?
Yeah, we are seeing trends that it is younger people in the second round who have gotten infected more so than older individuals. And I think it's multifaceted. There is real quarantine fatigue that's set in. It's also that older individuals have taken heed of the precautions to be even more cautious than they were back in March. But we have to remember that what starts in the young does not stay in the young. And now we are actually seeing the median age of infections trend up. And the important thing for us is not to shame and stigmatize young people. It's to recognize that many of them may be essential workers who have had to go to work, that others are experiencing quarantine fatigue, but rather to work with everyone and encourage everyone to see this as we're in this together. We all need to wear masks. We all need to practice physical distancing. All need to wash our hands. We all need to do these basic public health interventions, because other countries have done it. It's not that they have a vaccine or a magic treatment that we somehow don't have.
One last question for you. I mean, we're still battling misinformation about this virus. Just this week, Sinclair Broadcasting delayed an interview that it had planned to run with a discredited scientist claiming that this disease was manufactured by Dr. Fauci. Why do you think misinformation about this disease is so persistent, and how do we stop it?
I'm so deeply concerned about the rampant misinformation that there is, because public health ultimately depends on public trust. One reason for how we got to where we are is that our elected officials are not on the same page with public health experts. We need to be emphasizing that masks, for example, are a public health imperative, not a political symbol. We need to talk about how public health is the roadmap to getting our economy back on track, not the enemy of the economy or the enemy somehow of public education. Ultimately, this is about all of us in this together, protecting one another and helping to stem this deadly pandemic.
That's Dr. Lena Nguyen, an emergency physician and visiting professor at George Washington University. Dr. Nguyen, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the election is a little more than 3 months away, and a number of Senate races are looking tight, including in South Carolina, where Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is facing a challenge from Democrat Jamie Harrison. That race is where we turn for this week's Senate Tracker. Victoria Hansen, reporter with South Carolina Public Radio, joins us from Charleston. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with Jamie Harrison, who was born to a teenage mom and later became the first African-American to chair South Carolina's Democratic Party. He's been highlighting that story in ads. Listen.
My grandparents didn't have much, but they raised me right. Taught me what most South Carolinians know. Character counts. So does hard work and helping others when you can. When they struggled to read their bills, I helped read them. When they lost their home, I promise to someday buy them a new one.
And Jamie Harrison did end up buying his grandparents that house. Tell us more about him and what he's campaigning on.
Well, you know, he has, as you just noted there, a great rags to prominence story. You know, he's a 44-year-old African-American man who grew up poor in rural South Carolina. He got a scholarship to Yale. He was a teacher. He went back to give to the community. And he's also the former chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party and associate chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Really, his big message, his big push is that Lindsey Graham has changed and that he no longer represents what is best for South Carolina, but what is best for Lindsey Graham.
And would you say Harrison is more of a moderate or more on the sort of Bernie Sanders wing of the party?
Well, that depends upon who you ask. If you talk to his camp, they say he's more of a moderate. But if you talk to Lindsey Graham's camp, they pretty much try to paint him as a Democrat with socialist views and policies. And they try really hard, especially in the ads, to link him to Nancy Pelosi.
Well, Lindsey Graham has been a big supporter of the president, at least recently. Of course, he initially opposed Trump as a candidate pretty strongly. He was on Fox News recently and had this advice for the president in this election.
You go on the offense, Mr. President. In your second term, what do you want to do? Finish the job of your first term. Keep building the wall. Fix a broken immigration system. More judges. Make sure Iran never gets a nuclear weapon. I think the president's right on all of these issues. He's for Lord.
What is Graham campaigning on, and how much is President Trump factoring into his message?
Well, you know, Graham's big message is basically you have a very stark choice come November. You can go with, again, as his camp will tell you, the socialist views of the more liberal Democrats or keep free enterprise and less government. So they really are trying to align themselves still with Donald Trump. But of course, Harrison's camp is trying to show the differences, what basically Lindsey Graham was saying about the president before he was elected and what he's saying now.
Well, and before he was elected, Lindsey Graham called the president a race-baiting, xenophobic bigot, and the president called Lindsey Graham a disgrace, a nut job, and one of the dumbest human beings I've ever seen. That
yeah.
was Trump
yeah.
talking about Lindsey Graham. Is Lindsey Graham going to face any trouble from voters for all that, this total flip-flop on his relationship with Trump?
You know, there are people who will tell you in this day that that is a problem for them. But you have to remember, despite all the advertising dollars, all the money that's being brought into this race, this is still a very red state. It's a deep red state. You know, again, we're talking about President Trump won 2016 by more than 14 percentage points. And this won't be easy. I mean, basically, Harrison's going to either have to win over Trump supporters or find people voting for Trump but not willing to vote for Lindsey Graham.
Mm-hmm. But what are the polls saying? Because I know there was one that just came out that mm-hmm. shows a very tight race.
Yeah, this is the poll that came out very recently from Jamie Harrison's camp. It's an internal poll. It's a Democrat poll. And it puts him basically in a statistical tie with Lindsey Graham. It finds Graham with 43% of the vote, Harrison 41%, but with a 3.5 margin of error. Now, Graham's camp hasn't really said much about these polls. But to be fair, the polls have basically gone back and forth over the past couple of months. Inside Elections ranks the race likely Republican. That was 2 weeks ago. Elections Daily ranked it safe Republican just last week.
Hmm. Do you expect President Trump or Joe Biden to visit the state? And on the issue of Joe Biden, you know, he used to be pretty close with Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham has said he's one of the greatest people he's ever met, Joe Biden.
Yeah, but if you watch the latest ads, that's not what he's saying anymore. I talked to both camps just yesterday, and when I asked the question about, you know, visits from the candidates, they said, you know, we just don't know. We're in a time of COVID, the pandemic, and, you know, South Carolina is definitely a hot spot. So they haven't heard anything, and I don't think they're really expecting anything at this point. As far as the campaigns and how they factor into their races, you know, Joe Biden energized a lot of black voters, especially when he was endorsed by Congressman Jim Clyburn. African Americans make up more than 50% of South Carolina's Democratic voters. And perhaps whoever he chooses as a running mate could make a difference.
That's Victoria Hansen, a reporter with South Carolina Public Radio. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
If you know anything about Today Show co-anchor Al Roker, you know he's kind of a jack of all trades. He's been telling us the weather for four decades. He has his own entertainment company, hosted a show on the Weather Channel, and has written several best-selling books. So, of course, he has a few lessons to teach us along the way. Roker has now decided to share some of those lessons in a new book that's part memoir, part teaching tool, and a lot of encouragement thrown in. It's called You Look So Much Better in Person, True Stories of Absurdity and Success. He joins us now via Skype. And Al, as you write, you weren't always this confident TV personality that we know now. In fact, you were a nerdy high school AV club kind of guy. And you write that while in college, you got your first job as a weekend weather forecaster in Syracuse, New York. And tell us the story from there.
My department chairman, Dr. Lou O'Donnell, the late Dr. Lou O'Donnell, decided, you know, it worked at the station, WTVH. Anyway, he put me up for the job. And, you know, I went down, I did the audition, and he said, okay, we'll let you know. And I just kept calling the news director. And back in the day, you got to remember this, 1974, there were actually switchboard operators. And the switchboard operator's name was Rosie. And you got to the point where she knew my name. I kept calling to ask for the news director. Well, oh, dear, he's not in right now, but I'll tell him you called. And finally, this one time, she put me through. And he said, look, you know, I got to get you off my ass. You've got the job. And he's, I said, okay, well, go ahead. I didn't ask him, when do I start? What do I do?
So you're, I had, like, to call, okay, back, yes.
You know, yes, yes. And but that was my start in television.
That is the theme of this entire book, is really taking a step and saying yes to so much. I want to talk with you, though, about the emotion in the book. I mean, you cried at work, Al. I mean, they tell us that is like the number one cardinal rule is not to cry at work. TV can be so cutthroat. I mean, what lessons do you want people to take away from this story, this you bringing heart to your work?
I think it's about passion, you know, and being able to tell people it's okay to be passionate. It's okay to show emotion. You know, I had a very good role model in my dad, in that he was a very emotional, demonstrative person. And so I learned from him that, you know, as a man, it's okay to cry. It's okay to show emotion.
Yeah. One of the great love stories of our time on television is really you and legendary weathercaster and personality Willard Scott. I mean, I think I learned about the power of mentorship just by watching you two interact with each other on the Today Show. It's a small but really powerful part of your book.
Well, he's just a terrific human being. He literally is like my second dad. In fact, he's the same age now that my dad would have been if he were still alive. Most people in this business are not generous enough to reach out to a colleague, let alone a total stranger. And he did that out of the blue, called me, invited me to dinner. And from that day on, we've had this, you know, we didn't work together. We worked at different stations in Washington, D.C. And then he got plucked from D.C. to go to the Today Show. And I went to Cleveland, worked at the NBC station, and we kept in touch. And then I moved to New York to work at WNBC. And he was the one that, you know, said, look, you know, it's time for me to step back a little bit. You ought to put Al in there. And so, you know, the generosity and the just the sharing is something that's always stayed with me.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something else. So we're in a moment where so many media people are sharing their stories of experiencing racism in the workplace or racist remarks from coworkers. You tell the story in this book of an anchor you worked with early in your career who said something racist to you on air, not even in the newsroom.
Yeah.
Can you tell that story and what you want readers to learn from that story?
At the time I was working in Cleveland and our station was in downtown, and downtown wasn't a great spot at that point. And there was a homeless gentleman who was happened to be African-American. And one night our anchor man, Doug, was going to his car and this guy ran up behind him and bopped him on the back of the head and ran off. And there was no harm, no foul. It's basically something that all of us wanted to do to Doug at one time or another. Well, it's now 6 o'clock and we're on the news. And his wife / co-anchor, Mona, starts to introduce me. And Doug interrupts her and says, Mona, before you introduce Al, I don't know if you heard, but last night after the 11 o'clock news, one of your people attacked me. Mm. And that's one of those time stand stills moments. You're not quite sure what to say. And I just looked at him and I said, Doug, why would a weatherman attack you? And then just turned to my single camera and went off into the forecast. What I didn't know, of course, the switchboard was flooded. People were outraged. And he was suspended, demoted to a reporter, and then eventually within 6 or 7 months left the station. You know, I could have gotten really angry on air. Mm-hmm. And I felt that it was better. And the point was made by kind of pointing out the ridiculousness of the statement. Not everything requires a sledgehammer. Sometimes a chisel and a small hammer can create more impact than brute force.
And a quick wit, because Al, I don't even know if I would have come up with that line that quickly.
Well, you know, look, every now and then, I like to say a broken clock's right twice a day.
You mentioned your father quite a few times. He was a bus driver in Queens, New York, and he gave you advice so many parents of color give their kids, that you have to work twice as hard and be twice as good as the kid next to you. Our kids are experiencing such a different life than we did. Is this a lesson that you impart on your kids today?
I still do. Even before George Floyd, you know, as we've become more aware of different standards of policing, and especially because I have a black son, but with all the kids, I tell them, look, you can't act the way your white friends do. You know, like my son takes the subway, and you know, kids sometimes just for fun will jump the turnstile. Well, you know, it's okay if your white friends do it, but if it's a group of you, you'll be the one that's picked out. And of course, he should be in any case, but especially dealing with the police, it's yes sir, no sir. You don't try to think you're funny or show off. And it wasn't until all of this that I was able to crystallize what I feel every day. And that is, I involuntarily breathe a sigh of relief when my son comes home every day.
Oh.
And he's a kid who's got some special needs, and he's a big kid. He's got a deep voice. Sometimes he's not aware of the space that he takes, could bump somebody. Mm-hmm. I just worry.
Yeah. I want to talk with you about weight. Most of us know your journey. And this book is called You Look So Much Better in Person, which I chuckled because as a former television reporter, I've heard this so many times. I also heard, I want to know if you've heard this. I've also heard, you're not as big as I thought you were when people see me.
Yeah, I the opposite. I thought you were a lot taller. And, you know, I gave the book that title because it literally, I hear it, you know, every day I would go out to the plaza to shake hands. Somebody will say, every day, someone will say, oh my gosh, you look so much better in person. And and you know they don't mean it as an insult. And so you're gracious. Well, thank you. But it's like, dude, it's not really a compliment. I make my living on TV. You know?
Yeah. Is it true that despite having to get up at 3:45 every morning for decades, you've only overslept once?
Yes. Technically, I did oversleep. At the time, I was doing a 2-hour morning show before the Today Show on the Weather Channel called Wake Up With Al. So the show was on at 5. I woke up at 5:20. I was, jeez. So I called in. I said, all right, I'll be there by 6. And I made it by 6 o'clock. And no offense to the Weather Channel, but that was the Weather Channel. You know, the big show, the Today Show, I was on time for. So I didn't quite understand why people were like, I mean, it was in USA Today, for gosh sake. I mean, above
we're
going to
end it right here. You've answered it and we are moving on. I know it actually is a testament to have to get up that early every day and never wake up late. So I think it's why people really just admire it, you know?
Well, thank you.
Al, you know, ultimately this book is about optimism. I mean, is that right? And if so, how do you hold on to that through all your decades of broadcasting?
I am a believer in the best parts of people until they show me those other sides. And I think that especially today, we have to be optimistic. We have to be realistic, but we have to be optimistic. And I considered such an honor and a privilege, one of, if not the last interview with John Lewis. I got to talk with him. I asked him, I said, you were out there in the trenches. Does what you're seeing today give you hope? And he said it gave him such great hope for this country when he saw all those young people of all colors and genders out there. Mm. He said, and as he says, we've gone too far. We aren't going back. And those young people out there give me hope. Here's a man who has seen triumphs and tragedies and is still optimistic and was till the very end. And to me, that's the lesson.
Al Roker's new book is You Look So Much Better in Person, True Stories of Absurdity and Success. Al Roker, thank you so much.
Why, thank you. I appreciate it. And I hope everybody stays safe and enjoys the book and buys two in case you read it so much that you need another one.
Funeral services will be held tomorrow for the late Congressman John Lewis. And for many younger people, Lewis's message of getting in good trouble for the sake of progress has now become a galvanizing rallying cry. Nathan Onibudo is an upcoming high school senior and on the student body of the Fairfax County School Board, which recently voted to rename the Robert E. Lee High School in Springfield, Virginia, after John Lewis. Welcome.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Nathan, John Lewis's name was on a short list, and of course it became the winning name. What does this change personally mean to you?
Personally to me, as an African-American student in the county, it means a lot because it shows the changing of the times, and it shows how far I think we've come as a society. But more than just that, I think it's even more meaningful because all of the things that John Lewis stood for as a person in our country, as an American hero, is applicable to the ideals, goals, and, you know, things that we want to teach all students, despite race, color, gender, anything like that. And I think that that's extremely powerful.
Your school student body is very diverse. 46% of the students identify as Latino, nearly 13% Black. You've really laid out what it means for you personally to change the name from the Confederate General Robert E. Lee to John Lewis. But some might say it's just a name. I mean, why is it so important when it's just a placard on the front of a building?
I think there are two things that really stuck out to me, because this was obviously an argument that we heard, because changing the school name involves community consensus. We want to make sure we're doing something that the community supports. And I think two things stuck out. And one of them is that names matter because words matter. What we say, what we do, implicitly teaches our kids messages. When we're teaching students at that high school about the Civil War and what the Civil War was fought over, but the person we're choosing to memorialize on the name of that building was a Confederate general as opposed to, let's say, a Union general, that means something. I mean, whether or not it's overt or implicit, it's meaningful, it matters. And then on the second hand, it's the fact that it's more than just a name. It was the picture of the general that sat in the foyer of the building. So I think that the feelings of the students matter, and a lot of students felt negatively about the name. And for students to learn, they have to feel welcome in their school environment.
What advice would you have for young people out there all over the country who might be going to schools that have problematic names and they're thinking about perhaps being a part of an action to change the name?
First, I would say you do have a voice. Your feelings matter, your thoughts matter, and your experiences matter. Student-led change, student-driven change is possible. And I'd say the first steps that you can do is to collect consensus, you know? Talk to your friends, talk to your classmates, start to see if you guys are on the same page about the way you feel about your name. Maybe start a petition. I know petitions were a big part of this process. Gather consensus, gather, you know, a groundswell of support, and then contact your school board. I'm lucky to have the position I have, and I'm starting to realize school boards across the country have a lot of power to decide a lot of these different things. So your voices matter, student voice matters, and I think in our current time, a lot of people are beginning to realize that.
That's Nathan Onibudo, student body representative on the Fairfax County School Board in Virginia. Nathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The number of migrants making the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean or across land to reach Europe has been increasing in recent weeks. In July, more than 5,500 migrants arrived by boat in Italy, raising concerns about the spread of COVID-19 there. Greece has been at the center of the migrant crisis in Europe for years. Let's check in on the situation there via Skype with Ava Kase, who's a researcher with Human Rights Watch. She's at a park in Athens where she's been interviewing migrants. And Ava, give us a sense of how many migrants are coming over this year in the middle of the pandemic.
Compared to what was happening in 2015 and the years after, the numbers have dropped dramatically. However, we see over the last few months an increase in arrivals, despite the intensive pushback operations that the government is implementing and that Human Rights Watch as well as other organizations have documented, both at the land border and at the sea border. Despite that, and despite the fact that the government is pushing back people to Turkey, we've seen an increase in arrivals over the last few months.
And where are they coming from?
The vast majority of arrivals in Greece still are from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. But we also have other nationalities from African countries, from Pakistan. But the vast majority are from Syria and Afghanistan.
And what are the conditions when they arrive? How does it work given the situation with the pandemic?
Depends on where they arrive. If they cross through the sea to one of the Greek islands, they would have to stay in quarantine in one of the camps that the government has set up near the sea border, near the beaches. And they will have to stay there, but without, according to what we have documented, without any real protective measures. And then once the 14 days have passed, they will be transferred to one of the big camps where, unfortunately, there are currently 26,000 people in facilities that are designed for 6,000 people. So as you can imagine, it's almost nearly impossible to follow any social distancing rules, to wash your hands without waiting in the queue, to take your food without waiting in the queue next to other people. It's very hard to protect yourself from COVID-19.
Have there been any outbreaks?
No, there haven't been. And this is, I would say, out of pure luck so far.
And once these migrants are in these camps, what happens to them next? Are there still programs to resettle them in places like Germany and in Scandinavian countries and other EU countries?
So there is, first of all, what we call the family reunification scheme. So if you have a family in another member state, you're allowed to apply to reunify with your family. And now, over the last few months, there's been joint collective effort by member states to relocate voluntarily. So it's not a compelling mechanism. It's not obligatory. But member states can opt in and decide to relocate some people from the islands or from the mainland. This has mainly focused on unaccompanied children, children who are traveling without a parent or a caregiver and who are stuck in those horrible camps. But, for example, Germany has expanded this voluntary scheme to relocate also families that have one or more members who are really sick, for example. Mm-hmm. But just to say that the numbers of relocation are very low. We're talking about, you know, each country pledging to take 10, 15, 20, 100 people, while in the camps there are 26,000 people living in horrible conditions.
Now, you mentioned some of the migrants are being sent to Turkey in a deal that's been worked out and has gotten contentious over the years. What's happening with that situation at this point?
Yes. So these people that I described are not sent to Turkey under the EU-Turkey deal. We're talking about illegal pushback operations. So people landing on Greece's shores, on the island, being apprehended by Greek law enforcement officers, the Coast Guard, not being registered officially, taken back to the sea and being put in rescue tent-like rafts and left to drift near Turkish water. And that's where Turkish Coast Guard will pick them up and take them back to Turkey. And the same happens at the land border. So we're talking about people managing to cross to Greece and even managing to move deep in the mainland, getting some kind of documentation, but being apprehended by the police, taken back to the border, and in secret operations, pushed back through the river to Turkey.
I also have to ask you about the children, because you just mentioned children who are unaccompanied, and I assume have made a very dangerous journey across the water to get to Greece. And just give us a sense of what they have gone through. Have you spoken with any of them?
Yes, this is one of our focuses, the challenges that unaccompanied children face in Greece. They've been through perilous journeys. They've been through child labor in order to survive, through, you know, negotiating with smugglers. And they managed to get to Greece. And what they face in Greece is, again, another horrible situation. Many of them are stuck in these island camps without access to anything basic because the special facilities for unaccompanied children are already overcrowded. They have to fend for themselves and sleep literally on the ground, unprotected from the violence in the camp, from, you know, adult strangers, from traffickers. But you also have part of these children who, over 1,000, who live homeless in city centers like Athens. And then you also have at around 200 unaccompanied children who are detained in police station cells, so they are put behind bars, usually in the basement of police stations, for their own protection. This is a system that Greece has established and detains children for their own protection in those horrible cells until a place is found in one of the shelters. We've launched a campaign in April calling on the Prime Minister to free the kids, to release them, because it's not a big number. And because a detention cell is never a good place for a child.
And yet, of all the countries in Europe, Greece is actually doing more than most when it comes to helping refugees, right?
Yeah. I mean, yes and no, because Greece has always treated refugees and asylum seekers, and Greece as a country has seen itself as a transit country. So it has never invested into the integration of people. It has never realized that people will stay here. So now we're facing a new situation where you have recognized refugees, so not asylum seekers anymore, who are homeless in squares and parks in the streets of Athens. We're talking about thousands of people. And currently, as I speak to you, I am in one of the parks in central Athens interviewing people who were asked to leave from the camps because now they are recognized refugees, but without any tools about how to rent an apartment, how to learn the language, how to find a job. And they find themselves homeless in the streets of Athens.
What is the long-term solution to this? Because especially in the time of the pandemic, many countries, all countries, are going to be even more skeptical than before about bringing in refugees.
Well, we as civil society should push them more to accept refugees. This is an important part of the solution. More solidarity with Greece, burden sharing, a permanent mechanism to relocate people from external border countries such as Malta, Italy, Greece, and to take them, you know, in other countries in order to process their asylum applications. Of course, financial support to Greece, but not only that, pressure to Greece to use wisely the funds that are given by the European Commission and the European Union.
Do any of the refugees that you speak with want to eventually go back to their home countries?
Yes, I would say more of the Syrians. They still hope that one day their country will, you know, be out of war and that they will be able to go back and rebuild it. This is less seen among the Afghan population because they have a war for so many years. I think that they lost their hope, so they want to find a new life. But in my experience and from what I see when I speak to people, they always, you know, if the situation was better in the countries, they would return there.
That is Ava Kase, who's a researcher with Human Rights Watch, joining us from a park in Athens where she's interviewing refugees as we speak. Ava, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Black musicians are leading violin vigils across the country, from Aurora, Colorado, and New York City to Portland, Oregon, in remembrance of Elijah McClain, a young black man who died in police custody. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Claudia Mazur reports, and a warning, this piece contains sound of McClain's arrest that may be hard to hear.
911, what is the address of the emergency?
Just after 10:30 p.m. on August 24th, 2019, the Aurora, Colorado Emergency Dispatch Center received a call about a suspicious person.
Were any weapons involved or mentioned?
No.
The caller says a sketchy-looking black man holding a bag and wearing a ski mask is walking down the street, waving his hands in a peculiar manner. The caller notes he might be a good person or a bad person. Officers are sent to investigate. At that moment, Elijah McClain was walking back home from a convenience store where he had purchased some iced tea for his brother. Anemic and often cold, McClain would frequently wear a runner's mask to stay warm in the evenings. He was listening to his music loud, dancing, sometimes even air conducting along with it. An accomplished and self-taught violinist, McClain would volunteer at a local animal shelter, playing his violin for kittens to help calm them, he would say.
Hey, stop right there. Stop. Stop. I have a right to stop you because you're being suspicious. Turn around.
No, I am an introvert. Please respect the boundaries that I am speaking. I'm going home.
Relax or I'm going to have to change this situation.
In the next few seconds, McClain is slammed to a wall and taken down. In the scuffle, he is accused of going for an officer's gun and put in a chokehold.
My name is Elijah McClain.
Yeah,
that's
all. We're gonna use karate.
That's what I was doing. I was just going home. What? I'm just different. That's all.
Elijah McClain was 23 years old.
Tonight we are here to honor, to celebrate the life of Elijah McClain.
I was laying in bed and I really probably shouldn't have been looking at the phone, you know, because I knew it was going to be bad. And I knew my mental health was just hurting. But I read it, yeah, and it just kind of like broke me completely.
That's how Carla Milugo described reading Elijah McClain's final words back in June. Though McClain died nearly a year ago, the current protests against police brutality have renewed interest in his case.
No justice, no peace!
So I just had the idea to do a violin vigil. I made a poster and sent it to my friend in Denver and we posted it and it kind of just took off on its own.
People as far as New York City and Los Angeles saw this poster and wanted to also hold their own violin vigils. They reached out to Milugo for advice.
The main request is that the vigil would be led by black people. Even though a lot of people relate to Elijah, the major issue that we are all fighting for right now is just to protect black lives and to end systemic racism and police violence.
Milugo also had some ideas about the performance itself.
You know, originally it's supposed to be like a improvised harmonization for Elijah because of Elijah being a self-taught violin player. Like we have to like figure it out together, see how we can sync up through the uncertainty and the chaos of this moment.
There is this shying away in our instrument from expressing ourselves in ways that aren't pre-written. And it's just a very vulnerable thing to do.
Violinist Chibia Ulinwa led the Portland vigil that took place during the 4th of July weekend. Nearly 100 string players came together to play for hours.
To see the classical string community come together and try something new and something that they felt uncomfortable with, it was purely amazing.
For many, the vigil was their first time taking part in any form of protest. Mary Sutton, a Portland musician and music teacher, also shared,
"I was nervous to come, honestly. I have not been around people, and I don't like shouting and things like that. And I don't know, maybe it's like for the emotional release also."
That's exactly what Carla Milugo had in mind.
It just seemed like people needed something that was special like that instead of just the protests, because protests, they kind of end up in the same way. Like you would kind of already guess that the riot police would come and end a demonstration.
As daily protests and marches in many cities hit the two-month mark, people on both sides of the barrier have asked how sustainable this action really is. Many artists and activists are taking this as a call to find new ways to show up.
I really hope that everybody can find some way to feel comfortable to advocate for the injustices that people are experiencing in America. For the longest time, I didn't think that there was a way that I could. I really don't. I think that's something that people that aren't really musicians don't understand. We are trying to express without words.
Because much like Elijah McClain, a lot of us are a little introverted, maybe a bit different. For Here and Now, I'm Claudia Meza.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.